So, time to write a note. I mean, as long as you're running off with me, don't you think you should at least tell your mother? Chapter 13. Dee Dee's Sunday morning began with a phone call. Walking into her office, no rest for the wicked, or for a homicide supervisor who just landed a major case, she was juggling coffee in one hand and her cross-body leather messenger bag in the other. She barely set down her travel mug in time to snag the receiver.
Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren. Is it true? Did that man take my daughter? Do you know what happened to her yet? For the love of God, why are we having to learn all this from the press? What kind of unfeeling monsters are you?
Dee Dee slowed. She didn't recognize the voice, but could deduce from the level of anguish she was most likely talking to Stacy Summers's father. Given the beating Boston PD had taken in yesterday's news cycle, rumored suspect in college student's kidnapping found dead, Boston police refusing to discuss circumstances. She shouldn't be surprised. And yet still.
Sir? With whom am I speaking?
Colin Summers. Who the hell do you think?
I'm sorry, but I have to ask the question. As I'm sure you've learned by now, the press isn't above resorting to tricks to get inside information.
An angry sigh on the other end of the receiver, the sound of a man trying very hard to pull himself together. Dee Dee used the moment to set down her messenger bag, then pull out her chair and take a seat at her desk.
Is it true?
Colin Summers whispered at last.
At this time, we have no evidence linking Devin Goulding to your daughter's disappearance.
Stop. That's cop speak for bullshit. This is my daughter we're talking about. Please, just give me the truth.
Sir, I personally attended the crime scene. We've spent the better part of 24 hours tearing apart the Gouldings' house. I am telling you the truth. We've found nothing to link him to your daughter.
But in the news, they said he was a big guy. They said he matched the picture in the video.
That's true.
And he was a bartender. That could be the connection. Stacy was last seen at Birch's downtown. He could have worked there.
We checked. Devin Goulding has no employment history with Birch's.
But what if Stacy met him at the bar where he did work? Maybe he spotted her there and he liked her. That's how these things sometimes work, right? He took one look at her and she became his target.
Dee Dee hesitated. Talking to grieving family members was her least favorite part of the job. It was tempting to answer all their questions, to soothe and to explain. But the truth was, her primary obligation wasn't to Colin Summers or his wife. It was to Stacy. And working a case was as much about safeguarding key details as it was about discovering new ones. She couldn't risk telling Mr. Summers everything they knew about Devin Goulding. There'd been too many other occasions where the grieving father had shared valuable information with his wife or best friend, who inevitably shared it with another person, then another, until the next thing the police knew, everything they couldn't afford known about their ongoing investigation was now fodder for the evening news. Most family members would tell you they'd do anything to help find their loved one. Unfortunately, for their sakes, what the investigating officer genuinely needed from them was restraint.
Dee Dee said.
Did Stacy ever frequent Tonic Bar?
I don't know. She wasn't a big drinker or a big partier, but she was social, he conceded. If her friends wanted to go, she'd follow along.
Dee Dee nodded. That was consistent with what they'd established up to this point. Yesterday afternoon, Phil had personally visited Devin Goulding's place of employment, Tonic, with a picture of Stacy Summers. Several bartenders recognized her from the news coverage of her case, but none could place her in the establishment. Of course, that didn't rule out Devin Goulding having crossed paths with her at a different time or at a different bar. Boston offered up a robust scene for the college crowd. The choices were endless. Not to mention, given Goulding's abduction of Flora Dane, they couldn't argue that blondes weren't to his taste.
"Do you know Florence Dane?" she asked abruptly.
There was silence on the other end of the phone line, silence that definitely went on several beats too long.
"Why do you ask?"
Colin Summers spoke up at last.
"Has she been to your house? Has she met with you?"
"We met with her mother."
"What?"
"When your child disappears, there's a program. through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Another parent, someone who's been there, calls to offer support. Rosa Dane was appointed as our mentor. Within the first 24 hours, she called, then stayed on the phone with my wife while she cried. Have you personally met with her? She's been to our house a couple of times. She's been very helpful, Sergeant, after what she went through. She understands. She listens and she helps, which is more than I can say for the rest of you. Dee Dee winced at the man's bitterness, reminded herself again it was nothing personal. The family wanted answers. They wanted their daughter back. But to date, the detectives could only provide more questions at best and fresh suspicions at worst. And her daughter, Florence? Dee Dee pressed again. I'm familiar with her case, Colin Summers said, which was, in fact, no answer at all. She accompanied her mother on one of her visits, Dee Dee stated. No. Reached out via phone, email, Facebook. You know her, don't you, Mr. Summers? You've spoken to her personally about your daughter. No. But Dee Dee didn't believe him anymore. There was something more here, something he still wasn't willing to say. And then... Was she the one who killed him? Colin Summers asked. Who? Flora. Did she kill the bartender, the suspected kidnapper? Is that why you're asking all these questions? Dee Dee didn't say anything. So far, they'd managed to keep Florence Dane's name out of the news, mostly by virtue of not having pressed any formal charges against her, meaning there wasn't any information for overeager reporters to discover. Why would you assume that, Mr. Summers? You investigators have your sources of information. The families of victims have ours. And given how likely you are to share with us, we are all on the same side, Mr. Summers. We're all doing everything in our power to get your daughter back. Then why isn't she home? A click in her ear as Colin Summers hung up, clearly having gotten in the last word. Dee Dee held on to the phone receiver for a moment longer, feeling the weight of his rage. Indeed, 3 months later, why hadn't they found Stacy Summers? And what the hell did Flora Dane know about the college girl's abduction that the rest of them, apparently, didn't? 8:30 a.m., Dee Dee had mounds of reports to sort through and approve, from the night-duty detectives on down. The joys of management, the burden of restricted duty. As a field detective, she'd always groused about the need to dot every I and cross every T, and yet reports mattered. Paperwork created the building blocks of a prosecutable case, and there was no point in identifying perpetrators and making arrests if you couldn't actually put the rat bastards away. Paperwork mattered. Sitting here at this desk mattered. Then again, so did asking the right questions. What was it Dr. Keynes had said yesterday? Flora preferred an honest, straightforward approach? Dee Dee got up, retrieved her messenger bag, grabbed her travel mug, and headed out the door. Florence Dane's registered address turned out to be a third-story walk-up in an older, slightly tired-looking row home. This time of morning on a Sunday, the house and street appeared quiet. Dee Dee walked through the unlocked outer door into the requisite inner vestibule, lined with half a dozen metal mailboxes. Some were labeled with names. Flora's wasn't, instead providing only her initials, F.D., another security-conscious decision from a woman who clearly took self-protection seriously. The vestibule's inner door was locked, but, as often happened in frequently trafficked areas, hadn't been pulled tightly shut. Flora definitely wouldn't have approved of Dee Dee's ability to nudge open the door and walk straight in. She could buzz up. It would be the polite thing to do. But where was the fun in that? Instead, Dee Dee spied the stairs straight ahead and made the executive decision to hike up 3 floors to Florence's apartment. Of course, she hadn't counted on her breath growing quite so labored. Maybe it was time to cut back the hours in PT and work in some cardio instead. Nor was she expecting to arrive at Flora's door and discover it cracked open. Dee Dee hesitated, already feeling the hairs rise on the back of her neck. At first blush, there was no need for alarm. The door looked perfectly fine. No scratches on the locks as if they were jimmied. No shredded door jamb. And yet... She rapped hard. The door yawned wide. Flora Dane? Sergeant Detective D.D. Warren here to see you. No response. D.D. took the first step forward, reaching instinctively for her sidearm before remembering she still wasn't authorized to carry. Flora? You home? Florence Dane? Nothing. Not the sound of footsteps or rushing water or creaking inner doorways. D.D. took another step inside, encountering a kitchen dead ahead, tiny family room to the left, another open doorway that provided a glimpse of a bedroom beyond it. Lights were off. Granted, daylight streamed through the large bank of bay windows, but the sky was overcast, meaning corners of the apartment were still cast in gloom, giving the place a neglected feel. More than that, however, the apartment felt empty. For whatever reason, the front door had been left open, but Florence was no longer here. Which made no sense at all. A woman who made studying criminal behavior her bread and butter, leaving her apartment unsecured in downtown Boston? No way. Something was up. But what? Slowly, keeping her back to the wall, Dee Dee made the rounds, except in the end there wasn't much to see. The kitchen appeared immaculate, the modest seating area untouched. She used her toe to push in the bathroom door, taking in a pedestal sink, toilet, and standing room only shower. Nothing. Finally, the single bedroom. Again, using her foot to open the door wider, careful not to touch anything. She spied a double bed, covers pulled back and obviously recently slept in. Next to it was a single nightstand table bearing a lamp and a charging iPhone. Which gave her pause. Because in this day and age, who stepped out for even the briefest errand without first grabbing her cell phone? Next, Dee Dee eyed a rickety old desk, which bore a state-of-the-art Mac laptop. Finally, she let her gaze take in the room's main attraction. Newspaper articles, photographs, dozens of them plastered across all four walls. It took her only a moment to deduce the theme. Missing persons cases. Each and every one. 30, 40, 50 people, male and female, who'd stepped outside one day never to be seen again, including Stacy Summers, the Boston Globe article announcing her disappearance posted in a place of honor right above Flora's bed. Definitely Flora had been following the case. And now? Dee Dee circled in place, taking in the full weight of one survivor's obsession. And she suddenly had a very bad feeling about things. Chapter 14. When I was little, I had a hard time falling asleep. I would spend my days running wild across the fields of my family's farm and through the dark Maine woods, and yet no matter how often my mom ordered me outside to burn it off, come nightfall, I'd lie in bed with a spinning brain and twitchy legs. My mother developed an elaborate bedtime ritual to help wind me down. First, she'd place both hands on the top of my head. She'd gently stroke my hair. This is Flora's head. Then she'd move her fingers down, trace the shape of my eyebrow, the curve of my ears, the line of my jaw. These are Flora's eyes, cheeks. Ears, face. This is Flora's face. Next, she'd squeeze both my shoulders, not too hard, but firm. These are Flora's shoulders. More squeezing of both elbows, my wrists, all five fingers of each hand. Compression, I later learned. My mother was practicing a basic therapy often used for hyperactive children. Basically a joint-by-joint bear hug as she squeezed my ribs, pressed against the sockets of my hips, then finished with my knees, ankles, feet. This is Flora's leg, Flora's knee, Flora's ankle. This is Flora's foot. And now it's time for all of Flora to get some sleep. When I was little, I would giggle at the end. And, of course, I would beg her to do it again. Sometimes she would. But mostly I got a peck on a cheek, maybe an affectionate tousle of my hair. Then my mother was up and out, a busy single mom with many worries to tend and chores to complete. By the time I turned 10, 11, 12, the ritual died a natural death. Another stage from childhood passed through. Sometimes, when I was sick or feeling blue, my mother would return again. A quicker, abbreviated version, but just as comforting. Once I hit high school, my mother teased it was now my turn to tuck her into bed. Being someone who regularly started her day at 5, she certainly didn't stay up much past 9 or 10. Sometimes, if I was feeling mischievous, or maybe just missed her, I would show up and make a big production of it. This is Mom's hair. This is Mom's eye. Oh my God, what happened to Mom's face? If my brother was home, he might even join us. Holy crap, is that really Mom's hand? Before long, the three of us would have collapsed with a fit of giggles, my mother at the bottom of the pile shaking her head. Moments of a family. The kind of thing that somewhere in your heart you know is special, and yet you can't help but take for granted. After I was found, my mother arrived at the Atlanta hospital. That first night she touched my hair, traced the line of my brow, followed the curve of my ear. "This is Flora's face," she whispered to me. I didn't look at her. I kept my eyes open, my gaze fixed on the ceiling. I didn't have the heart to tell her that her hands felt like sandpaper against my skin, and that, far from soothing me, I wished desperately, with every fiber in my being, that she'd just stop. And yet, in the weeks and months to come, on the very bad nights when I woke up screaming again and again, and my brother hovered uncomfortably in the doorway, my mother would take her place on the edge of my bed. She'd once again trace my cheekbones, squeeze my shoulders, compress the joint of my elbows, wrists, all 5 fingers of each hand. Slowly but surely, my patient mother would help me find slumber again. I am asleep now, but it is wrong, bad. I need to wake up. I have a sense of urgency, dread, a bad dream. I'm having a bad dream, and I need to wake up now. Scream, yell, thrash. Then my eyes will pop open. I will find myself back in my own bed. My mother will be beside me, rubbing my temples even as I flinch. I'm moving. I shouldn't be moving. Wake up, Flora. Wake up. I try. I will my eyelids to roll up. I order my limbs to jerk to life. Nothing happens. I can't move. I can't see. I can't find my way back to the safety of my locked apartment or my childhood bed. A mist. I feel it cool against my cheeks. I inhale instinctively, wrinkling my nose at the smell. And then I am rushing away into the dark. My mother disappears from view, and even if her touch feels like sandpaper, even if I'm the one who constantly pushes her away, I still wish I could call her back. I need to tell her something. I need to say, I'm sorry. Wake up, Flora. Wake up. But I can't. I'm moving. I shouldn't be moving. I am in trouble.
Chapter 15. Flora's cell phone was password protected. No surprises there. Instead, Dee Dee used her own phone to make the call. Boston FBI field office, requesting one Dr. Samuel Keynes. It took another 3 minutes for the operator to take her seriously enough to track down a federal employee on a Sunday. One more minute for Keynes to return her call. From there, however, the rest was a matter of seconds. Yes, he'd returned Flora to her apartment on Saturday, and no, she would never leave her apartment unlocked. He'd be right over. Which didn't surprise Dee Dee at all. She didn't know much about victim specialists and their interactions with their charges, but it already had struck her that Keynes and Flora had an unusually close relationship. Dee Dee had just finished conducting a visual tour of the outside of the apartment, as well as an inspection of the fire escape, when Keynes pulled up. Keynes was wearing the same knee-length, double-breasted cashmere coat as the day before. How he'd gotten it dry-cleaned so fast, she'd never know, but it didn't contain the faintest whiff of human barbecue or rancid garbage. Maybe he'd simply willed the odor away. Walking up to the building now, shoulders set, gaze direct, he had that look about him.
the kind of guy who could take over the world through sheer presence alone. He also appeared grim. "When did you arrive?" he asked.
30 minutes ago. When you dropped Flora off yesterday, did you go inside?"
"No. Her mom was already here. I spotted her truck parked down the street. Flora headed upstairs to see her."
"Has Flora contacted you since? Phone, text, Facebook post?"
He shook his head. "Sign of forced entry?"
He headed up the stairs, already on his way to the third-story unit.
"Negative. Fire escape also appears clear, but get this. That door is also unlocked. The bolt's been undone. Same with all the windows. Each and every one of them may still be closed, but they're unsecured."
"Sounds like a message."
He was frowning.
"My thoughts exactly. But from her or about her?"
Topping the stairs, Keene strode straight inside the apartment, clearly familiar with the layout. He glanced around only briefly, then stated,
"Definitely her mother was here."
"What makes you say that?"
"Rosa cleans when under stress. The kitchen? That's her doing."
"And Florence?"
"More relaxed in her housekeeping standards, prone to clutter."
"So you dropped her off yesterday. She came upstairs to her mother, and then?"
Keynes produced his phone from his coat pocket. He hit a number while still walking around the gray-lit space.
"Rosa, Dr. Keynes, how are you?"
"I'm fine, thanks for asking.
You spent some time with Flora yesterday, didn't you?
I thought I saw your truck parked down the street."
"Exactly, I understand."
"I know. Her behavior does appear to be escalating."
"Yes, thank heavens she was all right."
"Her staying at the farm is an old argument, Rosa. You know I can't intervene, not that it would make a difference with Florence anyway. Did you speak to Flora again last night? Maybe before bedtime?"
"You called, but she didn't answer."
"Thank you. I'll do my best to follow up with her today."
"But of course. Pleasure to speak with you again.
Bye."
Keynes pocketed his phone, once again frowned. "Florence's mother left her shortly after 1 yesterday. She hasn't heard from Flora since."
"That unusual?"
"Not necessarily, but the unlocked apartment is." He walked into the bedroom, glanced at the plastered walls, but didn't seem surprised by the onslaught of articles. Instead, he headed for Flora's phone.
"Password protected," he observed, "so no way of checking the messages immediately. It's possible she headed out to meet someone."
"And left her front door open behind her?"
"No sign of forced entrance or signs of a struggle. Given Flora's training, if someone had tried to grab her, she wouldn't have gone down without a fight."
"Unless she was ambushed, maybe while she was sleeping."
Dee Dee gestured to the bed, which bore the only signs of disturbance in the whole place.
"But how would the attacker gain entrance? Flora would have definitely checked the locks before heading to bed."
Dee Dee sighed. That was the piece of the puzzle that kept stumping her as well. She'd only just met Florence Dane yesterday, but she already knew enough to know the girl was hardly foolish about these things.
"Let's check with the landlords," Keynes decided. "Maybe they heard something."
The landlords turned out to be an elderly couple, Mary and James Reichter, who'd owned the residence for the past 52 years and lived in the first-floor unit. They recognized Keynes from other visits and greeted Dee Dee with beaming smiles that made her feel like she should have come bearing some kind of housewarming gift. She and Keynes politely declined their offer of coffee, but still found themselves ushered into the front parlor, which bore an antique love seat and enough original oak trim to make Dee Dee salivate. She perched tentatively on the edge of the delicate sofa, letting Keynes take the lead with the questions, as he seemed to know the couple. It took some loud, if not downright shouted, inquiries to determine the Reichters had seen Flora return home yesterday, sometime around mid-morning. Her mother had already arrived by then, showing up again after lunch with some blueberry muffins to share. Excellent, excellent muffins. Rosa was an exquisite baker. Oh, yes, Flora. No, they did not remember seeing her again, but then they'd been watching their shows in the back of the unit, so she could have gone out. Possible. Was anything wrong? Something they should know?
Keynes trod carefully.
He had a delicate touch with the couple, Dee Dee observed, more neighborly than official, and yet at the same time keeping just enough reserve to have them striving to answer his questions.
Had they seen anyone else enter the building yesterday? Say a stranger? Someone they didn't recognize? No. What about sounds or commotions? Maybe a disturbance in the middle of the night? No, sir. And they would be woken up by such a thing. Didn't sleep so well these days. What about new friends or acquaintances they'd recently seen with Flora, or any inquiries about her apartment? Well, except for the building inspector. Didi and Keynes both drew up, exchanged a glance. Building inspector? Didi spoke up. Day before, or maybe the day before, the day before. Time gets a little confusing. James began, looking at his wife.
Tuesday, his wife provided. The building inspector came on Tuesday, said our place was overdue for review. All private rental units have to be inspected by the city every 5 years, you know. Why, it's been ages since anyone's visited us. Guess we really do lose track of time.
You showed him around the entire building, all the units? Keynes asked.
James showed him around the outside, the fire escape, but inside the units, well, navigating the stairs at our age.
Mary smiled apologetically.
We gave him keys to the units, asked him to please knock first to alert the renters. He wasn't gone long at all, did his thing, then came down to tell us all looked well. We'd get our updated certificate shortly.
Wait, Didi interjected. You have keys to all the units? Even Flora Dane's apartment? James seemed insulted by her tone.
Of course. This is still our house. We are entitled to access. Plus, for the sake of maintenance, or, heaven forbid, something like a fire. Our renters, they're very busy. It's easier if we can just go in, do what needs to be done, when it needs to be done. We've never had any complaints or problems, not even from Flora. We respect her privacy, of course. We understand.
The way he said the last word implied enough that they knew Flora's history and were familiar with why she felt a need for extra security. Was Flora home for the building inspection? Didi asked.
I don't know, dear, Mary answered.
Did you tell her about the inspection? Mention it when you saw her again?
No, I don't believe we've run into her since it happened.
What did the building inspector look like? Keynes asked.
Oh, he was a nice-looking young man. Dressed a little casual for my tastes. Tan slacks, a blue dress shirt. But then no one wears suits anymore.
He had an ID. I'm not naive, you know. I did make him show it. What about his size? Didi spoke up more softly. Big guy, small, young, old?
Oh, he was very official-looking. Clean-shaven, short, dark hair, and big, strong, like a fireman. He looked like a very capable young man.
Mary smiled brightly. A big man, a strong man, who'd been handed over the keys to Flora's apartment by her well-intentioned landlords. Didi looked over at Keynes, could tell from the expression on his face he'd just connected the same dots she had, such as... All the best locks in the world couldn't offer protection against a man with a key. Flora took pride in her preparations, and yet, if their suspicions were correct, her attacker had already been one step ahead. Keynes rose to standing, offering his hand, finalizing their departure. Out in the foyer, phone in hand, it only took Didi a matter of minutes to confirm what both she and Keynes already knew— Boston's Inspectional Services Department hadn't sent anyone to this building in the past few days, let alone had anything scheduled for any time soon. The building inspector guys had been a ruse, a very effective means of gaining access to Flora's keys in order to make a master copy.
"I'll call the crime scene techs," Didi said quietly. They headed back upstairs to wait in silence.
Chapter 16. I'm awake. My head jerks up, my eyes pop open, but I'm immediately disoriented by the fact I can't see. Black, thick and impenetrable, I feel a sense of urgency. Fight or flight, I gotta fight, except I can't see. Not at all. Up, down, left, right, I have no idea. I bulge my eyes as if that will make a difference. Then it comes to me. I'm in a room. I'm sprawled upon a bare mattress, wearing some kind of silky nightgown. My arms are bare, and cool metal bracelets encircle both my wrists. Handcuffs. I've been handcuffed, arms in front, hands at my waist. Furthermore, the manacles appear attached to a lead line of some sort, maybe rope, maybe chain, but I only have to give the slightest tug with my wrists to feel the corresponding resistance. I'm not just bound. I'm tethered to the ceiling, or a high spot on the wall. As for the dark, I blink my eyes. Nothing. I try again. Still nothing. My eyes are open. There's no blindfold around my head. It's the room itself. Windowless and, most likely, painted pitch black, until not a single ray of ambient light can penetrate the gloom. I wonder if I'm underground, and despite my best intentions, my heart rate accelerates, my breath growing ragged. Not underground, not buried, please, please, please. And for a moment, a split instant of time, other images come to me. Scenes from the past, another lifetime, another nightmare ago. I want to yell, scream, and beg, bang my fists against wooden walls, kick my heels wildly. Lying on the mattress, shivering uncontrollably, I dig my teeth into my lower lip, then ground myself with the pain. There will be no panic. There will be no pleading. So stuff it. It takes a few deep breaths. The taste of my own blood against my tongue, but bit by bit I feel my heart once again settle in my chest. Then I close my eyes, because whether it's logical or not, it makes the dark easier to take. Slowly it comes to me, my last memory, waking up in my own bedroom, the sinister shadow in the doorway, then a mist in the air. Chloroform, I'm guessing, or some other aerosolized sedative. I was drugged, and then a sense of movement. I wanted to wake up, but I couldn't. I was brought here, wherever here is. Immediately, I'm dismayed. Not for myself. Instead, I see my mother's face, the mother who baked me muffins and hugged me hard and begged me to take better care of myself. She loves me so much. And now I've gone and broken her heart yet again. Because I'm already pretty certain that whoever broke through three locks to get into my security-tight apartment, let alone prepared this room complete with chained manacles, is more than your average bear. This isn't me versus the arrogant loser I'd burned to death in his own garage, or even the amateur acts who preceded him. This is something worse. Something more. Someone to fear. And I wish for just one moment I'd been brave enough to tell Dr. Keynes everything that happened 5 years ago. But there are secrets all survivors keep. Most likely, I'm about to pay for mine. Just like Stacy Summers did. I fall asleep. I don't want to, but I can't seem to help myself. The residue of the drugs, maybe even habit forged years ago when I also spent hours, days, weeks at a time with nothing better to do. Fight or flight. Except being all trussed up on a bare mattress, I can't do either. So sleep becomes a flight of sorts, a temporary reprieve for my overworked limbic system, which can't figure out what else to do. So much adrenaline, stress, and fear with no place to go, nothing to do but wait. Wait, wait, wait. Wishing my eyes would grow accustomed to the dark, wishing for any sort of ease in the relentless tar-black gloom. After a while, I give up on sight and focus on touch instead. Moving tentatively, I dance my fingers across the mattress, identify its size, standard twin, feel the welting of the edges, become aware of a faint odor of mildew. It's thin beneath me, most likely old and tattered, maybe even tossed on a street corner, then harvested by my host for just this purpose. It's not particularly comfortable or soft or soothing, but I like the mattress. It's a source of thread and stuffing, maybe even wire coils. It's a tool, and I'll take it. Next, I explore the garment now draped over my body. I'd gone to bed in an old T-shirt and men's flannel boxers. Now I'm wearing some kind of short satin negligee, lace trim around the neckline and bottom hem. He changed my clothes.
While I was unconscious, he'd stripped off my comfortable nightwear and replaced it with a more feminine, sexy counterpart. I'm tempted to feel insulted and violated by this act, but mostly I'm confused. Most sexual sadist predators keep their victims naked. Easy access, further degradation, take your pick. Or they might clad their unwilling prey in various S&M outfits, gadgets that fit their masochistic fantasies. But this, a silk nightie, speaks to something else. It's attentive in a way I already have a feeling I won't like. Jacob rarely gifted me with pretty nightgowns or anything more than practical clothes. I was a possession, and who wastes extra effort on their coffee table? This man, the newest predator, is a freak. I repeat the word in my head, try to feel it forcefully. A freak. A mutant. An aberration. Something less than human. Nothing worth worrying about. But I'm lying to myself, because already I can feel the metal handcuffs cutting into my skin. And when I tug on my wrists to make my arms more comfortable, I'm terribly aware of the sound of a tethering chain unspooling from above. Enough. I sit up, swing my legs over the edge of the mattress on the floor, remind myself this is already more freedom than I had with Jacob. Wow, a whole room at my disposal. I might just get giddy with the rush. The dark is still endless, oppressive. I can barely make out the lighter shadow of my bare arms as I take the first tentative step forward. One step, two, three, four. The room is bigger than I expected. I still haven't come to a wall. Then my foot connects with substance, a rattling sound as a plastic container tips over. I reach down and explore with my fingers, but I already know what I've found, a plastic bucket. The latrine of choice for kidnappers and sadists everywhere. But of course. Behind the bucket, I discover a wall. Drywall. It surprises me. For some reason, I'd been expecting cinder block or maybe cheap wood paneling, but no. The wall is smooth and bare. Drywall, as in a real room of a real house. Which would also explain the thin carpet padding my bare feet. If I really am in a house, I halt, strain my ears, trying to get a sense of traffic outside or maybe the distant sound of footsteps echoing overhead. At first, I hear nothing at all, soundproofing to go with the blackout paint job. But then faintly, steadily, it comes to me. Breathing, in, out. There is someone else in the room with me. I'm not alone. I recoil. I can't help myself. Then, instinctively, I grab the empty plastic bucket and clutch it to my chest. As what? A hammer or a shield? I'm not thinking anymore. I want to. But for all my experience, training, and bravado, my heart rate has once again climbed, and I'm shaking uncontrollably on my feet, while across the room, maybe 5-6 feet from me, breathing. In. Out. In. Out. He's here, watching me, waiting for me to panic, freak out, beg for mercy, or just enjoying the show. Just like that, I'm angry. I don't care what he does or what he thinks he can do to me. Compared to Jacob Ness, Mr. Silky Nightgown, Mr. Breathing Heavy is nothing but a carnival sideshow, a freak. Just because he broke into my triple-locked apartment, ambushed me with drugs, and spirited me away to some blacked-out dungeon, I refuse to be afraid of him. Instead, I'm thinking of my first visit with Samuel, the day after I got out of the hospital. Do you remember what you did to survive, Flora? Every rebellion, every submission, every lie, every adaptation? My own slow nod. Good. Don't forget. Don't second-guess. Accept. It may not feel like it right now, but you're strong, Flora. You survived. Don't let anyone take that from you, and don't take it from yourself. You're a tough girl. 472 days later, you saved yourself. Based on that alone, you never need to feel frightened again. I set down the bucket. I focus on the sound of his even breathing. Slowly but surely, I match it to my own, until I inhale as he inhales, then exhale as he exhales. In, out. In, out. We are breath for breath, perfectly pitched. And I understand already, in this introductory battle of wills, the person who speaks first loses. He'll move, I'm certain of it. No one goes to this much trouble just to watch. So I fix my gaze in the direction of his breathing, and I stare as hard and defiantly as I can. Come on, freak. Show me what you got. In. Out. In. Out. I've never heard such even breathing, without the slightest quickening from excitement or a missed beat from shock. Just in. Out. In. Out. As if he really doesn't care that I'm upright and staring straight at him, as if he really is that much in control, with all the time in the world. My own breathing hitches. I don't mean to. Hate to give him the satisfaction, but the steady, even beat is getting to me. No one breathes that regularly. No one in this situation can possibly keep that calm. Then suddenly a dawning realization, a slowly shuddering fear. No, I don't want. Please, not. I can't help myself. Having had the thought, now I must know. Shuffling forward one step, two, three. Four. My toe hits it first. I stop, freeze in my tracks, and focus my ears once again. Breathing, much closer now, but just as steady. In. Out. In. Out. I extend my arms, order myself to be strong, remind myself I've already been through the worst. I can handle anything. Still, as my fingers encounter the first wooden edge of the coffin-shaped box, while from inside comes the continued sound of the occupant's steady breath, in, out, sleeping. Because what else is there to do when trapped in a dark wooden box? I close my eyes. It doesn't help. I can still hear her breathing. My fellow abductee, his prior victim, in, out, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no, I am not afraid. I hear myself whisper, but in my mind I can see Jacob, and he is laughing again. Chapter 17. Newbie Detective Carol Manley was the first to arrive at Flora's apartment, but if she seemed surprised to discover her supervisor actually on site, she did a good job of disguising it. Phil and Neil followed shortly after, and then the party really got started. District detectives were assigned to canvass the neighborhood and interview available residents for any possible witnesses to Flora Dane's recent comings and goings, while a sketch artist would be sent to visit the landlords. Carol volunteered to pull security video from the corner store, as well as peruse local traffic cams for any sighting of Flora. Given the volume of footage, however, they needed to narrow down the timeline of Flora's disappearance in order to be more efficient. Phil did the honors of searching her computer, while Neil placed a call to the girl's cellular provider and credit card companies. Unfortunately, Flora's network browser didn't show any activity for the past 36 hours, since shortly before she headed out for her ill-fated adventure with the predatory bartender. Her cell registered only a single call from her mom the evening before, while her credit card hadn't been used in a week. Frugal of her, but not helpful for moments like this. Dee Dee prowled the tiny apartment, feeling restless. Keynes was tucked in a corner, mobile phone pressed against his ear. He'd agreed to fill in the mom, not a job Dee Dee envied. Like most major cities, Boston had electronic eyes everywhere. From business cams to traffic cams to ATM cams, every street, every corner yielded possible surveillance opportunities. In theory, this should produce a bonanza of information for investigators, except that was exactly the problem. There was too much footage, and much of it low-quality resolution, meaning security footage worked best when used backward. First, formulate what you think there is to see, at what time it most likely happened, and then go look for it. So what exactly went down in this security-tight apartment? Yesterday, late morning, Dr. Keynes dropped off Flora outside. Her mother was already upstairs, had made muffins. She fed them to her daughter. They caught up briefly. So, Mom, about last night, how did such a conversation go? And what did Rosa Dane think of her daughter's late-night escapades? Dee Dee stood in the kitchen. She pictured herself as the mom, baking muffins. She pictured Flora walking through the door, clad in second-hand Boston PD sweats and covered in garbage. She remembered the smell that had coated her own skin from the crime scene, then, with a short nod, headed for the bathroom. Sure enough, on the back of the door hung a bath towel, still damp. She removed the lid from the wicker clothes hamper tucked in the corner and immediately wrinkled her nose at the stench. Garbage-scented Boston PD sweats. Check. So among Flora's first order of business upon returning home would have been to clean up. And then? Girl had been up 24 hours at that point. She would have been tired, as well as hungry. According to witness statements, she'd been drinking at the bar, not eating. Dee Dee was biased on the subject, but given a choice between eating and sleeping, she'd go with eating any day of the week, especially given that Flora's mother would have been waiting for her in the kitchen, with the scent of homemade muffins wafting in the air. Following that instinct, Dee Dee returned to the kitchen. This time, she discovered a gallon-sized freezer bag tucked in the corner containing 6 blueberry muffins. The leftovers, she would guess, and they still looked delicious. Next, she checked the refrigerator, where she discovered a brand-new jug of orange juice and a bowl of recently cut-up fruit. Edges of the apples were just starting to brown, so she was willing to bet they came from yesterday's snack with the mom as well. As for other contents, she pulled out some takeout containers, sniffed experimentally, recoiled. Best she could tell, Flora had one edible meal in her whole kitchen, and that was the food supplied by Mom. Which meant...
She never ate dinner, Dee Dee stated out loud.
Pardon? Dr. Keynes had come up behind her. He still wore his coat, though now it was unbuttoned. How he didn't sweat, given the stuffy confines of the small space, she'd never know.
Yesterday, Flora returned home, showered, ate with her mom a late breakfast, early lunch.
Brunch?
Sure, muffins and fruit, brunch, but that was it. I mean, unless she went out, which, given the lack of credit card activity, let alone her own state of mind,
she would have rested, post-adrenaline crash.
Okay, but she ate with her mom, what, 1, 2 in the afternoon?
Rosa confirmed she left shortly after 1.
So most likely she would have lain down for a nap. Too early in the day to go to bed.
Keynes shrugged one shoulder. Given the large windows, the overall brightness of the space, I suspect she would retire to her room to rest.
You mean the shrine to kidnapping victims everywhere?
Another elegant shrug. He turned and headed for Flora's bedroom. Dee Dee followed behind him. Like the rest of the apartment, the room was small. The newspaper articles plastered all over the walls offered its main distinction. Otherwise, just the modest desk and the rumpled bed, which definitely appeared to have been slept in. Dee Dee pushed by Keynes's larger build, which nearly filled the narrow space, to cross to the bed. She leaned over the thin pillow, sniffed experimentally. When she looked up again, she spotted Keynes studying her.
Searching for chloroform, she provided. It has a distinct smell, which takes a bit to fade. Might be traces on the pillow.
Or maybe that's just my imagination.
He would have to have subdued her quickly, Keane said. Otherwise, given Flora's training, where are the signs of a struggle?
He had a point there. The apartment appeared relatively untouched, one of the more unsettling things about the situation. And indeed, given what Flora was capable of.
He had already made a key for the locks. It's possible he was already inside, waiting for her.
Not likely. Rosa was here for several hours before Flora returned home. When Rosa is anxious, she doesn't just cook, she cleans. And if she was puttering around, tidying up this small space, Dee Dee filled in, where could an intruder hide that she wouldn't have seen?
Exactly.
Dee Dee nodded, following the train of logic.
All right, so first Rosa arrives at the apartment, lets herself in, does her thing, then you drop off Flora. Mom and daughter catch up, exchange words.
She eyed Keynes expectantly, but he refused to take the bait. Apparently he either didn't know what Rosa had said to her daughter, which Dee Dee didn't believe for a minute, or he didn't feel it was relevant to the investigation.
Mom departs shortly after 1, at which point we know Flora didn't make any calls and didn't use her computer or credit cards. Which leaves us with...
she took a nap. Didi liked it. Certainly, in her experience, unconsciousness was about the only thing that kept a younger person from his or her electronics. When she woke up, she said, gazing at the rumpled bed, he was here, already in the room, already standing over her. Because this is where he chloroformed her. Keen said.
Yeah, and she never ate again. I mean, up all night, then returning to muffins and fruit. I gotta say, first thing upon waking, I would have been famished.
I'm told you're a woman who appreciates an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Checking up on me, shrink man? You've been told correctly.
Keynes ignored her sarcasm, staying focused on the matter at hand. He already had a key made, meaning he could enter the apartment at any time. Didi shook her head.
He wouldn't go after her in daytime. Come on, the kind of guy who takes the time to copy a key is the kind of guy who does his homework. Given Flora's rap sheet, not a matter of public record. He would have done some digging. That whole ruse posing as a building inspector? This guy has patience. He would have taken proper precautions to abduct a target as high risk as Flora. Not to mention, this is a third-floor walk-up unit. She puts up a fight, the other occupants would come out to the stairwell to discover what's going on.
Didi paused, considered the matter. He needs it to be dark, she reiterated, otherwise he's too exposed.
Think about it, he can't use a rickety metal fire escape without calling attention to himself, meaning he had to have used the main stairs, just like the rest of us.
Does the building have a camera?
Former residential home? We're not that lucky. But consider his options. He knows he can get into the apartment. He's planning on ambushing Flora, rendering her unconscious, which means he then has to carry her out. Carrying an unconscious body down three flights of stairs is pretty noticeable. So he'd pick a time after dark, when most residents wouldn't be coming or going.
He watched the apartment, got to know the routines.
Consistent with someone patient enough to scam himself a set of keys.
He'd also be watching Flora, getting to know her routines. Keynes provided.
Didi nodded. She pushed her way back into the main living area, where she crossed to one of the front-facing windows. She drew back the filmy curtains Flora seemed to favor, the kind of gauzy affair that offered some privacy while also still permitting plenty of light, and peered out onto the street.
We should investigate vantage points, she murmured. Maybe even a new tenant in the surrounding area.
If our theory is correct, our guy would have had to have been hanging out for a while in order to learn everything he needed to learn.
Permit parking, Keynes commented.
Didi nodded, having noticed the signs earlier, meaning parking on these streets was restricted to locals who had to prove residency in order to gain a parking pass. Those who parked without one risked being ticketed, something else to have a local detective check out. Because their suspect definitely would have parked close in order to escape with an unconscious woman, meaning if he didn't have the proper permits, they might find a trace of a parking ticket.
Does Flora have a car? She asked Keynes, as it was possible the kidnapper had stolen Flora's own vehicle for transport.
No. All right, so we're talking early nightfall. Not so late that Flora had woken up and eaten dinner, but not so early that it was still light out. Say, 5:36.
Seems like a high traffic hour, Keynes observed. Risks the other residents coming and going from work.
Unless that's how he does it.
Didi paused, the idea grabbing hold.
Social engineering. That's his thing, right? Pretend to be a building inspector in order to get a key. Maybe he dressed up for yesterday's event as well. Boyfriend? Taxi driver?
Escorting an unconscious woman from her apartment?
Keynes raised an eyebrow. EMT, home health worker.
She glanced at him.
Local cop? An occupation that could easily explain the situation, assuming he was noticed. Then he'd simply brazen his way through, walk straight down the stairs with his drunk or sick or groggy female companion. In a neighborhood as high traffic as this one, simply acting as if you belong is half the battle.
Keynes nodded.
Officers should canvass the neighbors who were out and about yesterday around dusk, see if anyone noticed a particularly large guy who appeared to be assisting an impaired woman, maybe an official worker of some kind who blatantly stood out.
A particularly large guy, just like Stacy Summers's kidnapper.
Didi glanced at him. Did you know Flora's mom is a mentor for Stacy's parents?
Rosa mentioned it. Flora seems to have taken an interest in the case as well.
As you can tell from the bedroom wall, Flora is interested in a good many cases.
But she's looking for Stacy Summers's abductor in particular. The way she spoke at the crime scene yesterday, that's who she was hoping to discover at the bar, and immediately she drew a connection between that case and her own attacker.
"Do you know why she does it?" Keynes asked softly. "Why Flora continues to put herself in dangerous situations?"
Dee Dee shrugged. "Adrenaline rush, post-traumatic stress, some god syndrome where she enjoys reveling in her own power after 400-plus days of feeling powerless."
"I don't know," Keynes said, which surprised her. "I doubt Flora knows why she's doing what she's doing either, or at least can put her finger on one particular stressor. Who she reminds me of is a soldier who returns home from her tour of duty, only to re-up again and then again. At the end of the day, real life feels too alien, while knowing the war is still going on, that she has brothers out there still fighting."
"Is that what those articles are?" Dee Dee asked. "Her brothers-in-arms? The missing people she can't leave behind?"
"Maybe."
"Do you think there's a connection between Flora's disappearance and Stacy Summers' kidnapping?"
Keynes didn't answer as much as he hesitated. Dee Dee did a little double-take, letting the curtain drop and stepping away from the window.
"You do, don't you?"
"When Flora's landlady, Mrs. Reichter, described the building inspector, my first thought was the Stacy Summers abduction video. Not to mention, 3 months later, there are no leads, no additional witness statements, no new information in that case. You have to admit, it takes a particular kind of predator to pull that off."
"You mean such as the kind of guy who would pose as a building inspector to copy a set of keys?"
"The idea crossed my mind. Plus, the front door of Flora's apartment being left open, all the windows unlocked. It feels to me whoever did this, he's showing off, bragging even. Which would make sense if this isn't the first time he's gotten away with something."
Dee Dee arched a brow. She didn't know exactly what to make of Keynes's suspicions. Even if he was on to something, given how little they knew about Stacy Summers's disappearance, linking Flora's case to hers hardly helped them. What they needed was a detailed sketch provided by the elderly landlords downstairs. Then they needed half a dozen witness statements tracking the perpetrator's trek through the neighborhood, plus a parking ticket issued to the evildoer's personal vehicle. Short of that...
Dee Dee turned toward the window again.
"Is it possible we have it all wrong? Flora wasn't kidnapped at all, but simply broke under the stress of the past 24 hours and ran off?"
"No.
Because she wouldn't leave her cell phone behind, or her personal computer, yada yada yada.
No. Because she wouldn't do that to her mother."
Dee Dee sighed again. Everything about this case already hurt her, and she had a feeling it was only going to get worse. "I need to talk to Rosa, both about her daughter, but also her involvement with the Summers family."
"If I might make a recommendation?"
Dee Dee shot Keynes a look. "By all means."
"I don't think you should question Rosa just yet.
If anyone knows about the family dynamics and the latest developments, it's Pam Mason, the Summers' victim advocate. You want insights?
Speak to her first."
Chapter 18.
Would you like to know how to avoid abject terror? How to fight nighttime chills, the fear of the boogeyman under the bed, how to sleep like an angel, or walk down dark alleyways with a spring in your step? Do you want to know how to be me? First, you find the void. It's a place everyone has deep, deep inside themselves, that spot no one can touch. I have it on expert testimony that some find it through meditation or Zen retreats or the diligent pursuit of mindfulness. Let's just say I discovered the void under different circumstances. But everyone has it. A place where you stand in silence. A place that permits you to be untouched even in a crowded room. A place where you are utterly, totally, simply, terrifyingly alone. Once you are there, no one can hurt you. And once no one can hurt you, you never have to be afraid again. It's the darkness that gets to me. I keep thinking that my eyes will adjust, that there will be a lessening of the gloom, but no. The pitch-black depths remain absolute. I hold out my bound hands time and time again to test. I still can't see them. I'm left in a land